This episode of Registry Matters is proudly brought to you by our amazing lifetime patrons, Justin, Brian, Michael, John T., John D. Your support makes this podcast possible. Thank you. And don't forget, FYP.
And Joey says he's ready, so we are off to the races. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 351 of Registry Matters. Larry! Fine, sir. How are you this evening?
Doing awesome. Glad you could have me back for this one final episode.
One. This is the last one, I'm telling you. That's it. We're done. Lights out. Head over to YouTube and head over to your favorite podcast app. Make sure that you press like, subscribe, do all those happy, happy, joy things to help improve. Share the podcast. Make the algorithms happy. Do all that stuff. Helps, it makes a difference for us so that we can grow the audience. We even got a new patron today. That's awesome. And so what are we doing tonight?
Well, being that it's a holiday weekend, I was trying to keep it light, but as the day progressed, I made it heavier and heavier with different stuff that I added at the last minute. Chance is unable to join us because of the holiday. That means it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom. But with Mr. Doom and Gloom, we have a case from United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. And it's not a huge win for PFRs, and it's not even directly related. You're going to probably snarl about that, but it has to do with treatment needs and courts delegating those decisions to the probation authorities. Also, we have some late-breaking news from the 11th Circuit, and it's likely not good. And we have a discussion about the AI revolution, which was going to be the prime topic for this Labor Day weekend because of the dramatic changes that are happening in the labor market. And also we have one situation that's relatively common from a patron, and we're going to analyze it, and it deals with treatment amazingly.
Well, let's dive right into this one. Let's see here what I can do. I'll press this button. You've got some late-breaking news here, right? Tell us about what's happening here.
Yes, I haven't heard that in a long time.
I know. I wanted to see if I still had it, and poof, there it was.
So that is old archaic stuff. I don't think anybody that's less than 50 would have even heard that kind of sound in the background. This is a long-running case that we've been discussing on the podcast. I think we discussed it maybe in April or May. Regarding Alabama's law, a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld the district judge in late April. And then, this past week, a few days ago, there was a vote by the full court to hear the case en banc. And that means all the judges, and I think there's 22 to 24 judges in that circuit. And
oh, wow.
The previous opinion ended with some good stuff. It says, we conclude that section 15-20A-11D4 violates Henry's fundamental right to live with his child as a parent to care and the custody of his child because his conviction alone does not prove he's a danger to his child. And that was a huge win at the time, but it may be in jeopardy. And it goes on to say, but we conclude the district court abused its discretion and facially adjoining the state from enforcing the law because they found facial invalidity. And we talked about how that would, you could never get there because there has to be no set of circumstances where something could be done for a court to declare it facially invalid. And Henry did not meet that burden. And the case is Henry versus Abernathy. And so that's what the late breaking news is. And we really don't have any more news other than a one-paragraph order from the 11th Circuit saying that they have voted, polled the judges, and they have voted to hear this case en banc. And if you go to the 11th Circuit's website or any circuit, if they have a listing of their en banc cases, you'll see they're far and few between. So this is rare, and it's usually not good.
All right, so just to backpedal just real quick, this was a decision that was good for us, and now they have sort of internally overruled the judge to go back and hear it en banc?
Not quite. It was already at the 11th Circuit, and a three-judge panel had upheld the trial judge, finding that it was unconstitutional.
Right.
And that was back in April. But normally a party makes motion. One of the parties that loses makes a motion to hear it en banc or to reconsider. And this, the one-paragraph order says that the court polled itself, and this was done sua sponte, meaning that on the court's own initiative without a motion from the parties. That is pretty unusual. In my 191 years now of existence, I've not seen this more than a handful of times.
And if I may, people often think, well, I sure wish the Supreme Court would go back and re-blah, blah, blah, this particular thing. They don't ever can't do it that way. This is what you're describing is happening. Like, the Supreme Court can't go Smith versus Doe from 2002 or whatever it was. Oh yeah, we had that all wrong and we will re-decide. They don't ever do that. A case has to be brought to them. But that sounds like what you're describing here.
No, not exactly, because this is a case that's in the court. The court has just decided it in April with a three-judge panel, which is how they decide appellate cases. You can't, if you tried to run all the cases through all 24 judges, you would reduce the capacity of the court dramatically.
Sure. I understand.
So therefore, this panel has been overturned by the full court. But it was not by motion of a party. It looks like it was sua sponte. Right. And that means that, to me, it's very dangerous, because that means somebody, and likely a powerful judge, possibly the chief judge, which is, we got a future segment I'm building for the chief judge of that circuit, is the former attorney general of the great state of Alabama, William Pryor.
Okay.
And his confirmation to be on the 11th Circuit was so contentious, it took a long and torturous route for him to get to the position he's in now. But my suspicion, and listen, I'm saying suspicion, I have no proof. My suspicion is that Judge Pryor, or someone of his magnitude of those 24 judges, decided that they don't like this. And they went around and built support to revisit this decision.
So what would you just, you know, read in the tea leaves, Larry, throw some dice, see what you think. How's this going to come out in the end?
I think they're going to narrow the decision from where it was a really fine win. They may narrow it. I'd hate to think, it's hard for me to imagine, that they could find the basis to completely overturn it, because it was 111 pages, and we couldn't even cover it all. They did a very good job of documenting their reasoning behind their decision. So they may narrow it, but they certainly could overturn it altogether. But then that would definitely create a circuit conflict, because in Tennessee, they have an almost identical law. So I think you would have a split with the circuits, and then this would get to go to where everybody wants it to go, to the Supreme Collate.
And Ashley, the attorney that we have had on a bazillion times, says that you do have a constitutional right to be with your children, provided they're not the victims in this, which I totally understand that. But otherwise, she said that you have, it's an unenumerated right, if I'm not mistaken.
And that was in the opinion, yes. It's one of the most fundamental rights that a parent has. And it's interesting, coming from the state of Alabama, where they profess that they so much believe that a child needs a daddy and a mama. You've heard that, right?
I believe I've heard something along those lines, specifically a male dad and a female mom. No, what is it? Adam and Steve. Yeah, not Adam and Steve. And I don't know what the inverse of that would be. None of that. What? None of that hanky panky.
This is so ironic. And it's one of the many things of hypocrisy that gets to spew from the right, and they don't get held accountable by their voters. And I keep begging the audience, please, someone, say that you're willing to come on and criticize this hypocrisy, and we will open our FYP mics to you, because I'm begging. I want someone who sees the hypocrisy to criticize it, like I do. I criticize hypocrisy from my team all the time. But this is one of those things that drives me up the wall. They claim that they believe that a child needs both parents, and then they pass a law that says you can't be a part of it. And they have all these laws where you can't attend school, you can't do all these things, and yet they get to pretend that they want children to have both parents. Isn't that funny?
It is. I have something to play for that.
For you to come back and call bigots my admirers is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
Hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
Who was that?
I like it. That was Governor Maddox, Lester Maddox of Georgia in the 1960s.
Very well. What was the name of that show?
Was that Cavett?
I believe so. The Cavett Show?
I don't remember which one it was.
I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Well, okay, move along. This is a letter from JT that came in, I don't know, I was like sitting at dinner, and I was like, I should send this over. And it says, JT said, I messed up on probation. I have been in SOT, which I guess would be PFR treatment, and on probation since February of 2023 for indecent material involving a minor, with prison stayed and jail time imposed, but not executed subject to successful completion of my treatment. My probation officer claimed to have received a report of me accessing inappropriate sites. Now, I was not placed on device monitoring, although it was ordered by the court. I did slip and access a particular website on a couple of occasions on an account created prior to sentencing. I have a problem with, like, I kind of like accidentally did it kind of sort of thing. Like, you don't accidentally do it. But anyway, I denied it and was threatened with a polygraph. Upon notification that I was about to complete the main phase of treatment and enter the six-month post-treatment phase, my PO told my group therapist about her suspicion. He discussed it with me. I didn't admit it, but he told me if I did access the site, he wasn't really concerned enough to hold me back because the site was not related to anything illegal content or non-consensual behaviors. Now, what's your take on that?
Oh, that's a pretty easy one to have a take on. The probation officer wants him to fail. Now, that I can't tell you why. And I'd certainly be curious as to reasons why, but my suspicion is that the PO feels that the original sentence was way too lenient, and they like to substitute their judgment for that of the courts. And also, he has a job that causes him to travel. And certainly in this state, they're not fond of you moving around outside the county, and it looks like that he's traveling, according to what we'll get to later. They don't like that because the probationer has too much freedom. And there could be other reasons why they want you to fail. They could just have pegged him as a screw-up, but I suspect they just don't think he got the punishment he deserved, and they're looking for a way to tell the judge, see, you're wrong. Judge, look at here. Look at what he's doing. That's what I suspect.
All right. He went on to say also, he said since she failed to place monitoring on my phone, he wasn't interested in her accusations. He also told me I may be subject to polygraphs, but a polygraph is only a minuscule part of their consideration. To put things in perspective, I have been extremely active, successful, and truly shown great progress, and he believes in me, despite knowing I may have slipped. He was more critical and skeptical of her actions than anything. He wrote her an email telling her he wouldn't hold me back or take any action, even if her accusations were true, and the lack of monitoring was even more reason for an action. What do you think about that, Mr. Doom and Gloom?
Oh, that would have gone over like a lead balloon. The appeal would not have wanted a treatment provider to say anything like, if that's anything approximating an accurate recount of what the treatment provider said, they would be trying their best to get that person decertified as a treatment provider here. That's how much that would have gone, how well that would have gone over.
So then, I guess this is JT. He stated she called me in for a meeting a couple days later and restated her accusations and her intentions. I again denied, and she said their investigation will continue, and she has already confirmed a resource with law enforcement to investigate further to get the truth. She said they only want to get me help if I need it, if I'm struggling. Now that sounds like we're from the government and we're here to help, doesn't it?
It sounds exactly like that. It does. And unfortunately, he said, quote, I cracked and admitted accessing the site. She documented my statement and asked approximate dates and printed it out.
Now, JT realizes his mistake already. He said, I guess I should have known better, but she filed a formal probation violation with the court and said I'll have a court date set. She then said, although she knows I'm in love with my current provider, She's going to refer me to an in-person treatment rather than the Zoom treatment. She knows I'm unable to use my current provider in person because they are over 200 miles away. And I believe it's retaliation because my therapist doesn't agree that it's as serious as she does. My current provider is highly regarded as the best in my state, and I switched to them due to them having the resources to provide treatment directly related to my offense. I begged her to work something out with my current provider, and she said she would discuss it with her supervisor, but doubted it. Now, this sounds like a farce to me.
It's likely indeed a farce. And that's the reason why I refer to most PFR treatment. The arrangement that they have is merely a collaborative fishing expedition, because she was fishing for something and she's not getting it from that provider. So what do we do? Well, we got two choices. We give up and say, let's just let the guy graduate, or we send him to someone else. And she's not willing to let go of it because she wants this guy violated. But there's a bright side to this. If he were in this state, he would already be in jail. Because probation officers here possess arrest and hold powers. They issue, they're like a mini court when it comes to probation. They issue a detain and hold order. So they come out, lock you up, they take you to the jail, and they lodge you, and that arrest and hold order is the same as if a warrant had been issued. And many states, most states, I don't think allow that, but New Mexico does. So look at the bright side. He's not in jail yet.
He said she also forgets phone calls and accuses me of not reporting things, so I switch to email. She then fails to read a reply and berates me for not being forthcoming until I find the emails that include replies and I show her. She has taken two leaves of absence for 2+ months since my probation started and returns uninformed. I know you will say, don't rock the boat, and I probably shouldn't have admitted anything to her. This is getting long, so I'll wrap it up. Feel free to contact me to clarify. I tried to be as detailed and concise as possible. Also, I'm in the state of Minnesota. So just to push this out there, somebody in the chat said, rule number one, admit nothing. Rule number two, deny everything. He broke both rules.
Yeah, and I hate to be that direct, but that's one of the prime rules here. It doesn't matter if you fail a polygraph. You cannot gain anything from these people by admitting, even if you did what the deception is showing on your kabuki machine. You can't better yourself by doing that. I don't know of a single instance. Now, there may be one somewhere out there, but I do not know of a single instance where a person has admitted to something and then it going well for them. I wish I could say it works out that way, but I don't have any evidence that it does.
Okay, so since we've already let the horse out of the barn, what does he have? Anything to stand on now, or is it just like, just get your affairs in order and be ready to go?
I think he's got a pretty compelling case, actually. Assuming that the court is not out to get him, and if it's the same judge that sentenced him, one or two things are going to happen here. The judge is going to say, I told you when I sentenced you, I had a zero tolerance policy. And the lawyer, if the lawyer's thinking, the judge is going to say, judge, well, you did have a zero tolerance policy, and he's adhered to that. This event happened prior to sentence being imposed. I think that's the way you read it, right? It just happened not. And so he has not violated, and he takes this seriously. And so I think the judge, having sentenced him leniently, there must have been a compelling PSR in his favor. He's likely has very minimal or no prior history with the courts and was a stable, productive member of the community, and the judge isn't likely going to want to violate him for something he did prior to being on probation. I would find that highly unlikely. So if she's filed a violation report, I expect the judge to do very little with it except hold it in abeyance unless they come up with something stronger than what he's conveyed to us.
And abeyance would be put it just off to the side in case something else, and then we'll stack everything on top of it?
That's what I would expect the judge to do. The judge would say, I really am disappointed this case has come back before me, but it really doesn't rise to the level of meriting revocation because it was before you were, you know, in fact, legally, I don't think you can revoke from somebody for something they did prior to being on supervision. But I'm telling you this final time, I don't want to see you again.
Could you go over that again? Something that you were doing. So this guy was into whatever he was into that was legal, and he was doing that prior to.
Well, whether it was legal or not, it doesn't matter. He broke the law prior to being under supervision, so it's not a violation of his supervision.
I see. I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Even if it was illegal, I don't know what that site is. You didn't call it by name. I don't know if it's a good site or a bad site. But
it's a fetish site. It's a site that adults would go to find like-minded adults to do whatever they want to do, consensual and legally.
If he's been going to that site subsequent to being on supervision, that's going to be a different situation.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right. So let's talk about this decision from the Sixth Circuit. Now, you have this in here from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I've read it. I was doing the grass again, Larry, and I had that push mower thing going, and I'm struggling to see the connection to PFRs. You do this all the time where you like, let's see how far we can twist and mangle this and contort my face to see how you want this to fit into something that's PFR related. So what is your brilliant reason for wanting to discuss this?
Well, I have some brilliant reasons. It has to do it has to do with treatment and the delegation. Some believe there should not be any delegation, and the Supreme Court ended delegation when they overturned Chevron deference. I said then it's going to have minimal impact on how things operate because we have to have delegation. So therefore, this is another example of, you know, delegation is not going to end. Folks, get over it.
All right, well then I'm going to set this up, and this is the case of the United States of America versus Daniel Lockridge. Lockridge is a decorated combat marine and a convicted methamphetamine trafficker. He claims that after he returned to this country in 2009, he turned to meth. First to manage his post-traumatic stress disorder, then to make some extra money. He soon became his supplier's supplier. That sounds like something out of a bad gangster movie. Sourcing meth from Atlanta, Georgia, and reselling it to a supplier-turned-customer, among others, for distribution in Chattanooga, Tennessee. By the time law enforcement caught him, Lockridge had sold over 7 kilos of meth in the Volunteer State. I have no idea. I don't even know how much a kilogram is, like visually, and I don't know how much that's worth.
Did you say he became his supplier's supplier? Now, please admit, that's funny.
I did say that. That's why I'm saying it. It's like someone even wrote in chat. It's like, that's like Breaking Bad. That's like almost exactly the same storyline of the TV show Breaking Bad. Phenomenal show, by the way, Larry, if you want to watch a show that you might, I think you would actually like that one. Now, so I do agree that there's a certain amount of irony here. And in 2024, Lockridge pled guilty to aiding and abetting possession with intent to distribute meth. The district court sentenced Lockridge to 210 months in prison and three years of supervised release. Two conditions of Lockridge's supervised release require treatment for his mental health and substance abuse challenges. The first is a special condition that requires him to participate in a program of mental health treatment as directed by the probation officer until such a time as he is released from the program by the probation officer. The second is a special condition that requires Lockridge to participate in a program of testing and/or treatment for drug and/or alcohol abuse as directed by the probation officer until such a time as he is released from the program by the probation officer. Now, I take it that Lockridge didn't really dig those conditions too much?
He did not. At sentencing, Lockridge objected and argued that the district court must pre-authorize any inpatient as opposed to outpatient treatment under both conditions and set a frequency for drug testing under the second condition, the requirement to be drug tested. I've never heard of that argument before, and I've been doing this a long time. The district court, Lockridge argued, may not constitutionally delegate these decisions to the probation officer. The court overruled Lockridge's objection. Lockridge appealed to the Sixth Circuit, contesting these features of his sentence.
Now, I recall when SCOTUS issued their ruling overturning Chevron deference, you pontificated that it would have little or no impact on how things operate. Now, how can you not recognize that people should do their jobs and not shirk?
Well, I don't know how I can not recognize that. I just recognize the reality of what the situation is. Article 3 of the Constitution requires courts, consistent with congressional statutes, to exercise any discretion in imposition of punishment. But it does not require courts alone to propose the initial conditions of a sentence. The district court may use the assistance of non-judicial officers, as it does for other exercises of its judicial power, such as calculating damages. The judge doesn't sit there with a calculator and say, "Oh, now let me see that picture, and what do you reckon that car would cost to put it back in order? Uh-huh." The judge doesn't do that. They cited Thornton versus Carson decision in 1813. Now, we're not talking about something recent.
Analyzing, so you're talking about when you're in your ute.
Yeah, that was about 3 years after I was born. That decision was analyzing common law claims tied up in bankruptcy. What makes this assistance permissible is that Article 3 court does remain in charge. It reviews, then accepts, modifies, or rejects the non-judicial officer's recommendations. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch for the court to say that. The reality of it is the probation department and the U.S. Probation Service tells you that you're going to do this, and there is no review. You sign the document. If you disagree, you're facing consequences. It's signed under duress, and you have to take them to court if you don't like that. But they're putting the best spin they can on it to justify their decision.
Why can't judges decide if the treatment is needed and issue the order?
Well, they did. He decided. This judge decided that it was needed. But it would be terribly expensive and time-consuming. This type of collaboration between Article III courts and non-Article III officers is common in criminal sentencing. District courts regularly look to probation officers who lack an Article III commission to report on each defendant's background, to propose the guidelines, the sentencing range within the guidelines, and to make other recommendations about conditions of sentencing and victim impact and all that kind of stuff. While the probation officer's proposals benefit the court, they do not bind it. Judicial power is still with the court. Punishment remains with, and the final decision is made by the court.
Now, as usual, Larry, you are pretty much impossible, and I say that the probation officers should not hold all the power.
I agree, and they don't hold all the power. They just hold most of it.
Yeah, they do seem to hold quite a bit.
And it's often in the case within the future conditions of supervised release. Remember, he got 240 months. So 15% off of that doesn't take off much because this is a federal sentence. And the district court in this instance did not spell out precisely how these conditions would be implemented years in the future. It's hard to know what conditions the person would need 210 months out. Maybe he gets better. Maybe he gets worse. The probation officer is going to see him when he walks out the gate of prison. The federal judge is not going to see him. I mean, this is just silliness.
Now, I memorized page 4, and so the parties agreed that the district court could decide at sentencing whether Lockridge must undergo treatment. Here, mental health and substance abuse treatment during his term of supervised release. And the parties agree that the district court permissibly exercised its discretion in saying some treatment was in order. What separates the parties is whether the district court was required to specify the features of the treatment program's 210 months in advance. Now, by finally not deciding whether inpatient or outpatient treatment was required at Lockridge's sentencing, in other words, did the court abdicate its authority to make that decision? The district court did delegate.
No, it did not delegate that authority. If Lockridge does not want to undergo treatment when he's out, he can go back to the court and ask that the probation officer be overruled. It's not going to happen.
now, that would be funny. How often does that happen?
It doesn't happen, but he can do that. So the court stated, we have no reason to think that the district court relinquished its authority to select Lockridge's treatment programs to the probation officer by not making that choice at sentencing. And we have every reason to think that the court merely delayed making that choice. Almost two decades will pass before Lockridge begins supervised release, during which time he will attend 500 hours of substance abuse treatment while in prison and undergo any number of personal changes that a lengthy sentence will bring. No one, not the district court, not the probation officer, not even Lockridge himself, can predict at this stage whether Lockridge will require inpatient or outpatient treatment when he begins supervised release. I mean, you people need to get over it.
500 hours while he's locked up? That is a lot.
So
on this record, it thus makes sense to read the sentence as reserving for the district court discretion to choose treatment programs at a time closer to Lockridge's supervised release. At that point, years into the future, Lockridge's probation officer can assess his treatment needs and recommend inpatient or outpatient treatment to the district court. With enough time for Lockridge to object with the help of appointed counsel before he sets foot in any program.
Yeah, that was what the court said, and it makes sense to me. And they concluded with, quote, then and only then will the district court weigh Lockridge's need for inpatient treatment, if such a need exists, against Lockridge's liberty interest before these interests are compromised. He's going to have an opportunity. If they're trying to put him in inpatient treatment and he doesn't need it, he can contest it. The court, not the probation officer, will ultimately decide whether Lockridge must be involuntarily committed or must attend inpatient treatment. Inpatient treatment against his wishes. You don't really get to attend it. If you're inpatient, they lock you up. All of this ensures that decisions regarding Lockridge treatment will remain where Article 3 requires, with the district court.
Now, what about his other challenge on drug testing?
He didn't do so well on that either. Lockridge's second challenge fared no better. Lockridge argued that the district court needed to specify the number of drug tests required by the substance abuse special condition. They stated, the court did, the problem for Lockridge is that we already have held that district courts may collaborate with probation officers on this feature of a sentence. The district court may allow the probation officer to take the first pass at the number of tests required by special condition. So as long as the court remains free to modify that choice on its own initiative or response to a claim by the defendant. So he lost. And folks, you're going to have to live with the fact that the judges are not going to be the ones who make the decisions initially, and probably 90% of the time, they're going to go along with probation. So if they tell you got to do something, you're more than likely going to have to do it.
So I just want to point out something that I think is a little messed up with this. And let's see, I'm trying to put the timeline together that, so he came back to the U.S. I'm assuming he was a decorated Marine combat veteran, and he returns back to the U.S. and he turned to meth first to manage his PTSD. I'm pretty sure that I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that wouldn't be something that was prescribed to him for that. He would have been prescribed something else. I just wanted to try and make a connection that we sent him someplace and he comes back with PTSD and then he can't get the help he needs. So he ends up turning to illegal drugs to deal with it. And then he gets all screwed up because he's addicted to a drug because of something that we essentially caused for him.
Well, now that's making a lot of assumptions that we don't have in evidence.
Well, there's only one piece of that I'm making the assumption is just what was the primary reason he started using meth? Was that because it was prescribed to him for his PTSD?
Well, we don't know that he wasn't using it. We don't know that he wasn't using it all along, do we?
Well, we don't know that. That's true. All right. Well, anyway.
But
he still
yes.
had the PTSD from being in combat. That's really where I'm going with that.
Well, but that what you ought to do, if you believe in what you're saying, you ought to get a hold of the conservative members of Congress and say, look, yeah, you guys are the big supporter of the military and of our veterans, and you don't believe in them ever being mistreated. And here's an example of a person who went and defended us and put his life on the line, and we're spending $50,000 a year to keep him in prison for the next 20 years when all he needed is help. And I guarantee the conservatives will just line up down the block to help.
Absolutely. So I do need to ask you a question. Can you elaborate more on what the heck does this have to do with PFRs? I know you said delegation, but could you elaborate and like break it down for my pea brain?
Well, it's very common that PFRs are ordered into treatment. And the treatment you're going to have to do is going to be exactly what your probation officer tells you. You're going to have very little judicial review. And if you argue for judicial review, you'll end up like what happened in the first segment that we did.
Okay. I hope that covers the question from chat.
Yeah, this is very common that when you get supervised for a PFR type of offense, you're going to be ordered to undergo treatment. And if you push back, you're going to end up in jail.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, you can refuse the treatment. You have that option.
You absolutely do.
And did I ever tell you when I was out for, it could have even been a year that I was out, and they're like, have you started treatment yet? I was like, no one told me to go to treatment yet. And they're like, you probably should start treatment. And I'm like, I'm not going until you tell me to go. And even then, I'm not really excited about going. But so then the guy, I'm sitting there across from the PO, and he hands me this piece of paper, and he's like, I'm not telling you which treatment providers to see. And he's got two really like circled 12 times around. It's like, I'm not saying which ones you should call, but these are the ones that you should pick from. And he hands me a list of like 10 people, and two of them are like multiple times around. I was like, wink, wink, got it. I understand what you're saying.
Now, there are people who would not have chosen those two, and they would have gotten off to a bad start from the get-go, but you had a sense enough not to do that.
I chose one of those two, and I called the first one, and God, I don't remember the reason why I didn't stick with them. And I called the second one. I had two questions for them, and I was like, do you push polygraphs? And they're like, only if we feel you need one. And I said, cool. Do you have some kind of statement about faith, religion, anything of that sort? And said, nope, we don't do that here. I was like, sign me up. So. And that guy was on his way out, and he was retiring soon. So I was in treatment for 11 months. And like he was like, okay, you've passed through the whole book, and I'm retiring, so let's get you out of here. Sweet! 11 months. And I know people go to treatment for years, and this is just another somehow luck of the draw, bullet dodged, whatever. I know. I understand.
It was divine intervention.
Yes, it could have been that for sure. All right. Well, happy Labor Day. So it is Labor Day weekend. Today is what? August 30th, and Monday is the Labor Day weekend holiday. Dude, give us the quick little history. What is Labor Day?
It's a celebration of organized labor and all the achievements for better working conditions.
And this would be like, I went and toured a coal mine a couple years back, and they had like five-year-olds with candles on their forehead, and all they did was operated a door, and that would let them have housing for the family because they're the only male that could go work in the coal mine. Like, that's the kind of labor conditions you're talking about, I believe.
Yeah, back in the days of Samuel Gompers.
I've never heard that name before.
Well, Google it real quick.
Samuel Gompers?
Yep.
G-O-M-P-E-R-S? I've never heard this word before. Samuel Gompers was a British-born American cigar maker and labor union leader, a key figure in American labor history. And this was 1924. He was born in 1850, so one of your contemporaries.
Yes, we had dinner together many times.
And why am I looking up that dude?
He's the father of the organized labor movement.
I thought you were going to tell me like some schmuck that was doing terrible, terrible labor practices. All right.
No.
So the reason why we're like, this is a perfect time for us to do that is we're going to dive into something that's been rattling around in my head. And I know yours too, Larry. So this whole AI revolution, I have told you a bazillion times. I was like, truck drivers, it's over. When they can figure out how to make them drive on the highway, Larry, it's over. 4 million truck drivers. You're only going to need them to drive like around the town areas to do the pickup and the delivery on the highway. It's over. So, and I know AI revolution sounds like some sci-fi headline, but really it's not, because it's like right here. This thing is moving fast. And here's the part that gets under my skin. For folks like us, people have got, say, you know, some kind of blemishes on their record, so to speak, a conviction. We might be the first in line when pink slips start flying. And that's not just me being paranoid. And that's kind of how the world works. So tonight, we're not going to tiptoe around it. We're going to dig in. What's happening? Why it's happening? And more importantly, what, if anything, can you do to not get shoved off the cliff first? Larry, if you and I are standing on a cliff next to a cliff, I'm going to like kind of nudge you a few times pretty hard. Just saying.
I wouldn't be surprised, but what you said is right. And I want to emphasize something. This isn't some hypothetical prediction about what might happen in 2035. It's already happening. The data tell the story. Major tech firms, and we're talking household names, have already eliminated more than 77,000 jobs in 2025 alone. And the driver, a lot of the time, is automation and AI. That averages out to roughly 495 people every single day losing work. Think about that. Every day, 500 people have been displaced. And surveys confirm it. About 14% of the workers believe they've already lost a job to a machine or an algorithm. This is not the future. This is now.
So then here's a kicker. So who gets smacked first? Oh, you already know. It's not the CEOs. It's not the guy in the corner office. No, no. It's the folks already at the bottom of the ladder, the economically disadvantaged groups. That's how the reports phrase it, which translated from corporate speak means, yeah, that's probably us. People with records, people with gaps in the resume, people without all the fancy credentials. And it's not just those white-collar high-tech roles. I read about an e-commerce outfit that straight up canceled its entire customer support team because the bot was, I love this number, 85% more efficient. 85%. What about Microsoft? Thousands of cuts. Software engineers, not just software engineers even, marketers, even lawyers. How about IBM? Poof, 8,000 HR staff gone. And let's not forget MSN, way back in 2020, they thought, who needs human nuance? And replace their human reporters with AI because apparently humans don't bring anything special to the reporting. Right. And the shocker of shockers, it's always the entry-level jobs that get whacked first. Junior coders, designers, call center staff, the folks in data entry. You know, the people who are just trying to climb to the first rung of the ladder. They're the ones standing under the axe.
Precisely. And what stands out to me is how quickly the ground is shifting. The pace of this change is extraordinary. And yet, if you look around at the coordinated societal and government response, you won't find one. You won't find much. There's no real plan for retraining, no serious strategies for cushioning the blow to vulnerable workers. In practical terms, the burden falls to the individual, to us. If we want to survive in this new landscape, we can't wait for a rescue mission from Washington or Silicon Valley.
So here's where I want to pause and say, now don't crawl under the bed just yet, because yeah, it's grim, but there are slivers of good news. Or maybe silver linings is better. The World Economic Forum, bless their optimistic little hearts, they predict AI will destroy about 92 million jobs, but then magically also create 170 million new ones. That's their math anyway. And here's the surprising part. They're not all those high-tech, sci-fi, technical jobs you'd think of. Their own report says there'll be a boom in fields like delivery driving, construction, agriculture, food processing, and nursing. Basically, things that still need humans in the loop. Places where AI can't, at least not yet, haul bricks or take care of grandma. So maybe the future isn't all coding and algorithms. Maybe it's a little more hammers and hard hats.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic because one of our community colleges has its origin here. And being a technical school, they are reinventing themselves with bringing back more focus on trades. But which leads to the central question, how do you make yourself indispensable in the kind of world that we're facing? And the answer is both straightforward and challenging. Focus on the skills that AI cannot easily replicate. These are human-centric skills, communication, leadership, teamwork, empathy, judgment, the qualities that make us uniquely human. Very few counselors are going to be replaced. I don't think people are going to sit in front of a screen and talk to the computer. Maybe they will, but I just don't see that. So you've got to work in something in your resume that cannot be easily automated.
So you're talking about the squishy kind of stuff, the messy, unpredictable stuff, things that robots still can't really fake, at least yet. Keyword being yet.
Correct, because robots are doing things I never thought I would see them doing. Some companies are experimenting with retraining. IKEA, for example, gave displaced call center workers the opportunity to become interior design advisors. But these programs are thin on the ground. They're exceptions and not the rule. We cannot count on employers or even government to hand us new skill sets. And of course, we wouldn't want the government to do it because everything the government touches, they screw up. So we wouldn't want the government. We would want the private sector to do that, right?
Yes.
It's up to us to invest in ourselves, whether that's through community colleges, online courses, or even volunteer work that builds the kind of human skills that we've been describing. You've got to have something that that's unique.
Which is why I want to make a shout out to a website. There are other places like this, but one of them that I frequent is called freelearninglist.org. This isn't a paid spot, so I just happen to like it. I've encountered it through multiple different channels. They have a metric ton of resources, math courses, language courses like Duolingo, critical thinking, you name it. There are a bunch of podcasts on there, some of which I even have without. I knew about them before I saw them on the list. It's the kind of stuff that can actually help you level up without tuition bill attached to it.
Oh, that's an excellent illustration. Freelearninglist.org is the type of resource that can make a difference. Because the reality is large-scale retraining programs remain largely theoretical. Regulation is stalled, and it's likely to stay stalled in the current political environment. The clearest, most actionable path forward right now is self-directed learning, and get on with it.
And look, I joke about it sometimes. Here's the free website. Good luck not getting yourself automated. But seriously, that's smarter than waiting for Uncle Sam or some corporation to roll out a grand retraining plan. Because let's be real, those are thin on the ground. Free Learning List calls itself the internet's best education resource, teaching how to think, not what to think. Now, that is exactly what we're talking about when we say human skills. That's critical thinking, that's problem solving, that's learning how to adapt, which is the survival skill of the AI age.
Exactly. And to be clear, we're not just talking about soft skills. There's also tremendous value in becoming AI literate yourself, unlike me that's dodging most of it, learning how how tools work, learning how to use them effectively. So the recipe is both human-centric skills that AI struggles with and AI proficiency so that you're not left behind as the tools advance. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to do research with AI, and I barely can scratch the surface because I'm doing everything the old-fashioned way, and I'm not using my time very wisely.
I think we could give you a couple level-up sessions, and you would find it to be overwhelmingly helpful. Just a handful of different tools that you just end up collaborating with it, and it would help you immensely. I use it literally all day, every day. As a coder, I say, write me this kind of function. And not to say that I can't do it, but why spend, even if it took me a minute to write it, and this thing can write it in 10 seconds, I'm now 50 seconds ahead of schedule.
So that gives you 50 seconds of time to waste.
I mean, we could do that. But Larry, like, seriously, you probably grew up. Did you do, like, hand washing of laundry with a scrub board? Is that even of an era for you?
Yes, I'm familiar with that process.
So why wouldn't you have a washing machine at this point? If it's going to take you 7 hours to sit there and go scrubby, 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 scrubby for all of your clothes one by one, you just throw it in the laundry machine and you go do something else.
And I've made it clear, I'm a big believer in technology, but I'm also a believer in making sure the accuracy is there. And if we rely on technology that's not completely accurate, we're not serving ourselves well. But if it's 90% accurate, 95% accurate, there's no technology. I don't care the machinery that packs your boxes of cereal. It doesn't get every single box right.
Nope.
There's some where it doesn't. It goofs up. But it's probably 99.5% accurate, wouldn't you guess?
Probably. But they also then have the systems in place to check it. And I remember at the tobacco place, they're shooting boxes of cigarettes down the line at this speed, and there's a camera taking a picture of it, and if there's a defect on the box, it kicks it out.
Well, and that's the way I want to use technology. If I can validate the accuracy, but I don't want to put something out that I have not, I do not have confidence in. And based on our AI translation of the podcast, the accuracy is not there yet, at least on voice to text recognition.
Just on that subject alone, though, that was never the intent, was to have a complete product. But it was also, at least from that point of view, even at 100 words a minute, what do we speak if it's 200 words a minute for 60 minutes? Is that 12,000 words? If you type 60 words a minute, 12,000 words is still going to take you a long time to get through.
Oh, I agree.
It's going to take you like 4 hours to type it out.
I love the technology. I just wish I could have found someone who would actually pay attention and listen to the podcast and make sure that they correct all the mistakes. Because
I don't want to go through that conversation again. That's not the point. The point is that it was faster to go through it and do it that way than to have to go type it from scratch.
No, there's no debating that. That is not even worthy of debating because everybody agrees with that. It's a tool that helps you get to the finish line.
So at the tobacco place, like moments after I got hired there, they announced that they're going to close and move to a new location. And all kinds of people were like, I've worked here for 30 years. What do I do now? It's like, you probably should have thought about that weeks and weeks and weeks ago, instead of becoming comfortable on your laurels and just try to ride things out and get a pension and all that, keeping your skills somewhat up to date. This isn't what I'm really getting at. This isn't something specific to PFRs. This is to, as people age, they cost more for employers because of health insurance reasons. They probably make more. It's easier to hire the dude that's right out of college or just new on the job front. You can pay them half as much and they're cheaper in all aspects. They may have more energy, they'll stay late, whatever. And they shit can the old people. They shit can.
Okay.
And if you don't bring something addition to the table, which could be you have extra life skills, you could bring better soft skills. This is what I'm trying to ultimately talk about is those things here anyway.
Well, I'm hoping that our audience understands that you could likely be on the chopping block if you have a job that's readily convertible to technology. So you need to be thinking about this, because if you wait for the government, you may be waiting for something that never happens.
Can we talk about a particular person in abstract that is kind of almost like the nexus of this segment?
I don't know who that person is, but go ahead.
Well, there's an individual who is in our sphere who is a little bit on the older side, who has kind of backed himself into a corner and not evolved with the times. This has almost nothing to do with AI. This just happens to do with a changing job market and what services he would provide. And the market shifted out from underneath him. And now he's kind of in a shitty spot.
No, I think I now know who you're talking about.
I would imagine you do.
And yes, that is a prime example. And I've done the same thing. If I were to be looking for a job in the profession I've been in for 22 years, I would be worthless, largely, except for strategy and analyzing. I have no idea how to review discovery in the modern era, the way it's distributed to us, because it's changed so much since we were in that business, defending people and getting discovery. I would have to be completely retrained, or they would say, well, gee, we can't afford to pay you what you're looking for because you're only one-dimensional. We don't need just the skills that you currently have.
Yep. All right. Well, that's a happy way to end the Labor Day segment. I think the point of what we're trying to tell you is that you ultimately want to make it where somebody else gets canned before you, poop canned before you do. And you would do that by having additional skills that your job isn't specifically asking for. Soft skills, those would be, if you're doing this kind of job and you can have something that's like a cross-pollination, if you know more about math, if you can speak a second language, anything along those lines, they're going to make you a more valuable employee that has less of a chance, or at least someone else getting canned before you do. That's really all I'm ultimately trying to say.
And I think we should start at FYP education. We should start a retraining program for those who are going to be eliminated by AI.
I will offer services to people, telling them how they can have less chance of getting canned.
Sounds good. See, FYP provides a broad array of services.
Absolutely. All right, man. Anything else before we go and have a great weekend?
I think we're done. This went 54 minutes.
Right on time. And I want to definitely make sure that it was TJ that we did the email from earlier, correct?
Yes.
Or JT? TJ or JT?
JT.
And thank you very much for becoming a patron. And so make sure that you link your Discord account and you can come hang out with all the crazies that talk in there all the time about Jellyfin and so forth. Head over to registrymatters.co, email registrymatterscast@gmail.com, voicemail, Larry Loves Voicemails, 747-227-4477. And of course, if you are so inclined, head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to support us directly. And that is most appreciated. And I hope you guys have a great holiday weekend, and I will talk to you very soon. Have a great night, Larry.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.